Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Dave.
Today we have a very special guest joining us. We have George Fritzma. Let me tell you a little bit about George. So George manages FritzmaFactor.com. It's Fritzma Factor, your interactive hemostasis resource for precision biologics out of Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and COAG Conversations for Biomedica Diagnostics in Windsor, Nova Scotia. George is a consultant for the Laboratory Medicine Division of the University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Medicine, where he provides lectures for pathology residents and for hematology and anesthesiology fellows. George is a contributing author for Rodack's Hematology 7th Edition 2024 and The Quick Guide to Hemostasis and Transfusion Medicine 4th Edition 2025. He is the 2023 recipient of the American Society for Clinical Laboratory Science Lifetime Achievement Award. He holds a bachelor's degree in biology and chemistry from Calvin University, Grand Rapids, Michigan, a master's degree in medical laboratory science from Wayne State University, Detroit, and advanced coursework from the Illinois State University and the University of Illinois at Chicago. So, George, welcome. We're really happy to have you today.
Thank you, Melissa and David. I'm glad to be here. We're going to talk about some new von Willebrand disease clinical information. There's been some changes along the way. First of all, this is a list of clinical information about von Willebrand disease, just by way of introduction. Von Willebrand disease is associated with mucocutaneous bleeding. And it's usually traceable to events. So mucocutaneous means bleeding like bruising, nosebleeds, menorrhagia, sometimes throwing up blood, some things like that. Von Willebrand disease, if you are testing, if you're doing a laboratory test for von Willebrand disease, you will find that somewhere between 0.6 and 1.3% of us would qualify as having von Willebrand disease, as if our von Willebrand factor antigen level is less than 50 units per deciliter. However, about 1 in 20,000 of the population seek assistance for actual von Willebrand disease hemorrhage. So that's the prevalence of people coming to the emergency room for bleeding. The severity varies over time. It varies within the kindred. It's different for blood groups. People who are blood group O have lower levels of von Willebrand factor, for example. And in von Willebrand disease type 1, which is what we'll be talking about today, the level rises with age. And I'll be showing you an example of that. Symptoms are made worse by aspirin and nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories and are reduced by oral contraceptives. The symptoms disappear in the second and third trimester of pregnancy, and then they will reappear postpartum, oftentimes with the risk of hemorrhage at that time. So that's typical information. Here's an example. Here is a young woman, a child, I should say, who is 13 years of age and has just reached puberty. And she's not sure how much bleeding is supposed to happen. After a few months, she thinks maybe she's having a lot of bleeding. I think this is done by counting the number of tampons that are used or something like that. I have no experience along those lines. But at any rate, because of this, the mother was somewhat concerned and brought her to a primary care physician who then sent her on to a hematologist and found that her von Willebrand factor antigen level was about 30 units per deciliter. And this was back in 1980 when this occurred. And at that time, we used 50 units per deciliter as the cutoff. If you were above 50, you were normal. If you were below 50, you had von Willebrand disease. And so she then at that time developed or was told that she had von Willebrand disease. Determining if someone has von Willebrand disease is not all that easy, and most providers use this bleeding assessment tool, or BAT. And this is a summary. It's a bit more complex than this, but basically, the provider will document any one of these symptoms, a wound that bleeds, hematuria, gastrointestinal bleeding, and so forth, what happens when a tooth is extracted, and so on. And if none of these occur, then there are no symptoms, and they would not go forward with von Willebrand disease testing. A level of three, a score of three in men is thought to be an indication that testing is needed, and in women, five, that intervention may be needed. And it is regarded as predictive for von Willebrand disease in adult women, but really not effective for someone who is 13 years old. And here's why. This is some work that was done back in 2004, 20 years ago, but it is still accurate, or still valuable to realize this. And that is, if you were reporting, if you were comparing healthy subjects to people who are categorized as having type 1 von Willebrand disease by the von Willebrand factor antigen test as being less than 50, then you would have this much blending between the results. For example, nosebleed, here's the prevalence for nosebleed in normal individuals. Here it is for people categorized with von Willebrand disease. That doesn't cross over very much. But look at menorrhagia, for example, or dental extraction. There's so much crossover there that it really is very problematical to categorize somebody as having von Willebrand disease. And you can look at the rest of these numbers and see how much they overlap with each other. In 2004, the British Haemophilia Doctors Organization decided that we needed to have a new category called low von Willebrand factor. And this was followed up by the US National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute in 2008, saying that if the level of von Willebrand factor was between 30 and 50 units per deciliter, this individual was labeled as low von Willebrand factor antigen, and only when the result was below 30 was it labeled as von Willebrand disease. And the rationale was, first of all, the incidence, or the prevalence of bleeding and the prevalence of mutations, was higher at less than 30, and the inheritance pattern at less than 30 was mostly autosomal dominant. When the result was between 30 and 50, then the inheritance pattern was unclear in those families. So, and one concern was that if someone was labeled as a person suffering from von Willebrand disease, at least in the US, that would cause employment and medical insurance limitations. And so this avoided that issue. So we have used low von Willebrand factor for a long time. In 2021, all of these organizations, American Society of Hematology, ISTH, and so on, National Bleeding Disorder, National Bleeding Disorder Foundation, just recently changed their name from National Hemophilia Foundation to Bleeding Disorder, because hemophilia is being treated with a lot of bypassing therapy these days. At any rate, they decided to do away with that low von Willebrand factor classification and go back to labeling anybody with less than 50 units as having von Willebrand disease. This renaming in 2021 was categorized as low certainty. It's one of these expert opinion, or let's see, what did we call that? It was wise old men sitting around a table, I think we called that. Anyway, so they came up with that plan. And they did make the point that more molecular diagnostic work is needed. The rationale was this: if someone was categorized as just low von Willebrand factor, at least in the US, it might limit their access to clinical care. Also, in young women, even though they were diagnosed with von Willebrand disease, it may occur up to 16 years after the diagnosis, and so it was useful to have that diagnosis there. So that was the rationale. So this is a kind of a snapshot of von Willebrand disease, which is illustrates what is happening with all of us. So taking our same patient who had a level of 30 units per deciliter and was labeled as von Willebrand disease in 1980. She was later, she's 23, she's now married and is pregnant, and she's having no symptoms. And her von Willebrand factor antigen level is 40 units. So she's now should be categorized as low von Willebrand factor. Postpartum, however, her antigen level dropped to 15, and she was at risk of bleeding. Generally, in these cases, blood and plasma is set up for these girls, but it's often treated just with stimate. That's the like an asthma device that they discharge into their mouth, or tranexamic acid, and that usually can control it. Then at 40 years of age, she was asymptomatic, but she was still in the low von Willebrand factor, and we assume when she gets to be 55, she will not only be asymptomatic, but her von Willebrand factor level could go back into the normal range. Because it does rise with age. So what we're looking at is what you would call a snapshot of von Willebrand disease with that von Willebrand factor antigen. An article that just appeared in Journal of Thrombosis and Hemostasis last month proposes another approach to type 1 von Willebrand disease. And I'll be showing you a diagram that is perhaps easier to, well, I like a visual approach rather than words, but I'll go through this first. So they say anybody with von Willebrand factor antigen that's greater than 50 units are classified as healthy. Those below 30 as von Willebrand disease. Those with levels between 30 and 50 and who have significant bleeding that is recorded would be called type 1 von Willebrand disease. Those who have had no bleeding despite a hemostatic challenge are classified then as healthy, even though their von Willebrand factor level is between 30 and 50, they would be considered healthy. And then those with a von Willebrand factor level 30 to 50 and no bleeding, but who have had no hemostatic challenge, would be categorized as von Willebrand disease possible. And these last individuals would be monitored for bleeding symptoms and for von Willebrand factor antigen and might later be classified as type 1 von Willebrand disease. So this diagram shows you the same thing, and it shows that von Willebrand factor is a snapshot. Von Willebrand disease and the von Willebrand factor antigen assay is a snapshot. So here we have less than 30. These are categorized as von Willebrand disease, and likely can now we can now find the mutation that supports that diagnosis. Over here we have people over 50. They're in the green. They're healthy, no problem. The people in the middle, von Willebrand factor between 30 and 50, you have, if they are bleeding, then they are categorized as type 1 von Willebrand disease. If they have had no hemostatic challenges at this time, would be possible von Willebrand disease. And then if there is later a tooth extraction or surgery and there is bleeding, they would then be categorized as von Willebrand disease. If not, then healthy. Or finally, if they've had a challenge and are not bleeding, that would be healthy. Now, I should tell you, this last slide and these categories are just from a, I would call it an essay or an opinion piece that was in STH last month. This is not being adopted at this time, but this, which was recommended by O'Donnell and Baker and Attie, will come back to the people who made the decision to change back to the single categorization. So, and I'm kind of hoping, I think this is very practical and it helps us sort out what's happening with von Willebrand disease. So, thanks for listening, and I'll turn it back over to David and to Melissa.
That was really informative for me. And I think it kind of highlights a lot of the uncertainty that surrounded the diagnosis and categorization for a long time. And this is where the thing I struggle with things like this because I think how the medical community deals with these uncertainties sort of informs public opinion about the medical community a little bit. And, so it sort of feels like I think you put it the guys sitting around the table in the room, right? Like that when introspectively they might say privately that they're uncertain about something, but then they make this deterministic sort of certain type of judgment in the categorization of the disease or non-disease. That can be like problematic. I see that the authors of this latest article, you termed it a practical approach, and I think it acknowledges like a little bit of like the I don't really know, and that's how you gain trust.
Yeah, I love that, David. Now that everybody has access to their portal, and oftentimes they will see their lab results before their primary has had a chance to characterize them, they're going to see, okay, let's see, sugar, blood sugar is, say, 80 to 100, minus 101. Oh my gosh, I'm in trouble. And they need reassurance. And the primaries don't necessarily know. I mean, I think a lot of us just depend on that number, period. And if you're above that number, then you're sick. And if you're below it, you're okay.
I agree entirely. I mean, I've seen, as an from my role as an educator, sometimes I'll be approached by people, and they'll say my doctor says I'm iron deficient, and then I'll look review the CBC, and I'll see like, an 11.9 hemoglobin in a female, where like normal's 12 to whatever at that particular institution, and then their MCV is like 90, and I'm like. Well, yeah, it's a difficult time. I think information data can be wonderful and also problematic. Yeah, I'll stop sucking the air out of the room, Melissa.
Well, I think too, the working group that put out their results in 2021, like they did a nice job forming their group and trying to make sure they had patient representation and representation from all the major organizations. So I think they did a good job. And a lot of their recommendations were what we would call practical as well. And I think that article that you showed with those authors is just taking what they did and making it even more practical. So step by step, trying to make it even better. So like you said, George, I think they'll end up revisiting that and then coming up with even clearer guidelines for diagnosis. But I think too, just even the guidelines from 2021 that came out are so much clearer than what we had for diagnosis before.
Yeah, I do agree with that. It's really helpful. That low VWF category was ambiguous, and you really didn't know. And I like what these authors have done with that. Makes
Yeah.
sense. And I think the whole idea is that you're just taking a snapshot. It's a lot like, lupus anticoagulant testing. Okay, it was positive. We got to check it again after 12 weeks and see if it's still positive because it can be transient. And von Willebrand factor bounces around, even it's even affected by how you collected the blood. Left the tourniquet on for 3 or 4 minutes, and now they don't have von Willebrand disease anymore.
Well, and so two things. One, I think we should just emphasize too that most of this discussion has been around type one, which is the hard one to diagnose. Type
Exactly.
two and three,
Yeah.
that's pretty straight or forward. It's type one that's been the challenge. But I love the example of the snapshot that you gave of the female from
Yes.
13 to 55, because that really does showcase like this patient is going to have. Yes, von Willebrand's disease, but the disease is going to change as she ages or as she's pregnant. And of course, we know von Willi is a positive acute phase reactant. So inflammation, it's increased, and pregnancy is basically a giant inflammatory reaction. So I think all of that
That's all
really,
that
I think it really
estrogen,
showed like a really good snapshot of what happens to your von Willi with different levels of inflammation and with what's happening in the body.
right.
It shows how much, like, so I always talk about us as humans wanting to put things in boxes. We love to like label and categorize and organize, and like something like von Willi type 1 is sort of messy. Right, like it doesn't fit neatly sometimes. That case study following following that woman, yeah, was like eye-opening, and that I also like that you brought up at one point here in the presentation, employment and insurance, right? And how those things, like how a diagnosis and how we're diagnosing can be so influential on someone's life in these ways that we may not think of as healthcare providers, like in the moment. Like we're in the laboratory and we're concerned with getting, good data. And I think it's helpful to reflect on how much impact this can have on someone's life, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you're labeled as von Willebrand disease, or if you're labeled as hemophilia, other conditions, even cancer. A lot of people are cancer survivors these days. You say, "Oh man, they have cancer," and well, I don't know if that's you hate to label somebody with something like that.
Yeah, especially when it influences pieces of their lives that are important.
Yeah.
Hopefully the insurance piece, right, has kind of come to a successful resolution. But like being a pilot, right, your medical record is sort of attached directly to your employment and opportunities and things. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Makes some real limitations.
I
Yeah,
actually
that
had
was
a
awesome.
conversation yesterday with one of my students. He was like, "I have nosebleeds. Should I get tested for von Willi?" And I was like, "Do you have any other bleeding things?" And he was like, "No." And I was like, "You can ask your doctor if you want to." And he's like, "Well, should I?" And I'm like, "If you want to, you can, but do you want the diagnosis labeled on your medical record that you have von Willebrand's disease?" And he was like, "Huh. Why does that matter?" So I actually had this conversation with him about employment and getting health insurance and maintaining, like, if you're switching providers. I had that conversation with him yesterday, which is ironic that we're having it again today. But he was like, "Well, how can I get it tested without it going on my medical record?" And I was like, "No, that doesn't happen."
Yeah.
But
Well, we used
yeah.
to do that. You guys are too young, but yeah, back in the day, well, we just ran lab tests on ourselves and see what we had.
You have to be like shh about it,
Right, yeah, that's a secret. Just
yeah.
three of us and whoever sees this.
But
But yeah.
yeah. Yeah, I thought that was just good timing. We just had that conversation about the health insurance, so.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I've had somebody from on Fritzma Factor, lupus anticoagulant is a similar situation. And this person was had apparently been in Vietnam and was exposed to Agent Orange and wondered, if his lupus anticoagulant was related to that. And I'm always careful when I'm putting it in public. I'll say, well, your provider will be testing you again in 12 weeks. And that's my way of telling that provider, hey, you better test this person again in 12 weeks.
It is challenging too. I can't imagine being a frontline care provider and having to know all this hematology stuff on top of everything else. It's quite challenging.
Yeah, that's true.
But that was awesome. That was a really cool perspective. Made me think about von Willebrand's in a whole new light.
Yeah, I decided to stay away from the subcategories of type two. That you can tell yourself in knots over those. So it's
I'm
great
grateful.
for us who teach, we've got it all down, but it doesn't make it easy.
Yeah, but certainly the nuance of von Willebrand's type one is that's something that I struggle with as a teacher, and especially since I didn't have a ton of experience with von Willebrand's testing.
Oh,
So it really is a nuanced diagnosis. It's neat.
yeah, it is. It's true. Yep.
Well, George, thank you so much for taking the time to share your knowledge with us and with our audience. We really appreciate you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to work with you guys and invite me back sometime.
Absolutely. And
Okay.
everybody else, thanks for listening.
Thanks for your time.